options are free, or at the worst, cheap. Centrally, we just don't need to know what's going on when we buy cheaply, when we have the asymmetry working for us. But this property goes beyond buying cheaply. We do not need to understand things when we have some edge. And the edge from optionality is in the larger payoff when you are right, which makes it unnecessary to be right too often. The options of sweet grapes. The option I am talking about is no different from what we call options in daily life. The vacation resort with the most options is more likely to provide you with the activity that satisfies your tastes, and the one with the narrowest choices is likely to fail. So you need less information, that is, less knowledge, about the resort with broader options. There are other hidden options in our story of Thales. Financial independence, when used intelligently, can make you robust. It gives you options and allows you to make the right choices. Freedom is the ultimate option. Further, you will never get to know yourself, your real preferences, unless you face options and choices. Recall that the volatility of life helps provide information to us about others, but also about ourselves. Plenty of people are poor against their initial wish and only become robust by spinning a story that it was their choice to be poor, as if they had the option. Some are genuine. Many don't really have the option. They constructed it. Sour grapes, as in Aesop's fable, is when someone convinces himself that the grapes he cannot reach are sour. The essayist Michel de Montaigne sees the Thales episode as a story of immunity to sour grapes. You need to know whether you do not like the pursuit of money and wealth because you genuinely do not like it, or because you are rationalizing your inability to be successful at it with the argument that wealth is not a good thing because it is bad for one's digestive system or disturbing for one's sleep or other such arguments. So the episode enlightened Thales about his own choices in life, how genuine his pursuit of philosophy was. He had other options. And, it is worth repeating, options, any options, by allowing you more upside than downside, are vectors of anti-fragility. I suppose that the main benefit of being rich, over just being independent, is to be able to despise rich people, a good concentration of whom you find in glitzy ski resorts, without any sour grapes. It is even sweeter when these farts don't know that you are richer than they are. Thales, by funding his own philosophy, became his own Maecenas, perhaps the highest rank one can attain, being both independent and intellectually productive. He now had even more options. He did not have to tell others, those funding him, where he was going, because he himself perhaps didn't even know where he was heading. Thanks to the power of options, he didn't have to. The next few vignettes will help us go deeper into the notion of optionality, the property of option-like payoffs and option-like situations. Saturday evening in London. It is Saturday afternoon in London. I am coping with a major source of stress. Where to go tonight? I am fond of the brand of the unexpected one finds at parties. Going to parties has optionality, perhaps the best advice for someone who wants to benefit from uncertainty with low downside. My fear of eating alone in a restaurant while rereading the same passage of Cicero's Tusculan Discussions that, thanks to its pocket-fitting size, I have been carrying for a decade and reading about 3.5 pages per year, was alleviated by a telephone call. Someone, not a close friend, upon hearing that I was in town, invited me to a gathering in Kensington, but somehow did not ask me to commit with, "Drop by if you want." Going to the party is better than eating alone with Cicero's Tusculan Discussions, but these are not very interesting people. Many are involved in the city, and people employed in financial institutions are rarely interesting and even more rarely likable. And I know I can do better, but I am not certain to be able to do so. So I can call around. If I can do better than the Kensington party with, say, a dinner with any of my real friends, I would do that. Otherwise, I would take a black taxi to Kensington. I have an option, not an obligation. It came at no cost, since I did not even solicit it. So I have a small, nay, non-existent downside, a big upside. This is a free option because there is no real cost to the privilege. Your rent. Second example. Assume you are the official tenant of a rent-controlled apartment in New York City, with, of course, wall-to-wall bookshelves. You have the option of staying in it as long as you wish, but no obligation to do so. Should you decide to move to Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, and start a new life there, you can simply notify the landlord a certain number of days in advance and thank you goodbye. Otherwise, the landlord is obligated to let you live there somewhat permanently at a predictable rent. Should rents in town increase enormously and real estate experience a bubble-like explosion, you are largely protected. On the other hand, should rents collapse, you can easily switch apartments and reduce your monthly payments, or even buy a new apartment and get a mortgage with lower monthly payments. So consider the asymmetry. You benefit from lower rents, but are not hurt by higher ones. How? Because here again, you have an option, not an obligation. In a way, uncertainty increases the worth of such privilege. Should you face a high degree of uncertainty about future outcomes, with possible huge decreases in real estate value or huge possible increases in them, your option would become more valuable. The more uncertainty, the more valuable the option. Again, this is an embedded option, hidden as there is no cost to the privilege. Asymmetry. Let us examine once again the asymmetry of Thales, along with that of any option. In graphic 4 of your PDF, the horizontal axis represents the rent, the vertical axis the corresponding profits in thekels. Graphic 4 shows the asymmetry. In this situation, the payoff is larger one way, if you are right, you earn big time, than the other. If you are wrong, you lose small. The vertical axis in graphic 4 represents a function of the rent for oil presses, the payoff from the option. All the reader needs to note from the picture is the non-linearity, that is, the asymmetry, with more upside than downside. Asymmetry is a form of non-linearity. Things that like dispersion. One property of the option. It does not care about the average outcome, only the favorable ones, since the downside doesn't count beyond a certain point. Authors, artists, and even philosophers are much better off having a very small number of fanatics behind them than a large number of people who appreciate their work. The number of persons who dislike the work don't count. There is no such thing as the opposite of buying your book, or the equivalent of losing points as in a soccer game, and this absence of negative domain for book sales provides the author with a measure of optionality. Further, it helps when supporters are both enthusiastic and influential. Wittgenstein, for instance, was largely considered a lunatic, a strange bird, or just a bullshit operator by those whose opinion didn't count. He almost had no publications to his name. But he had a small number of cult-like followers, and some, such as Bertrand Russell and J.M. Keynes, were massively influential. Beyond books, consider this simple heuristic. Your work and ideas, whether in politics, the arts, or other domains, are anti-fragile if, instead of having 100% of the people finding your mission acceptable or mildly commendable, you are better off having a high percentage of people disliking you and your message, even intensely, combined with a low percentage of extremely loyal and enthusiastic supporters. Options like dispersion of outcomes and don't care about the average too much. Another business that does not care about the average, but rather the dispersion around the average, is the luxury goods industry. Jewelry, watches, art, expensive apartments in fancy locations, expensive collector wines, gourmet farm-raised probiotic dog food, etc. Such businesses only care about the pool of funds available to the very rich. If the population in the Western world had an average income of $50,000 with no inequality at all, luxury goods sellers would not survive. But if the average stays the same, but with a high degree of inequality, with some incomes higher than $2 million, and potentially some incomes higher than $10 million, then the business has plenty of customers, even if such high incomes are offset by masses of people with lower incomes. The tails of the distribution on the higher end of the income brackets, the extreme, are much more determined by changes in inequality and changes in the average. It gains from dispersion, hence is anti-fragile. This explains the bubble in real estate prices in central London, determined by inequality in Russia and the Arabian Gulf and totally independent of the real estate dynamics in Britain. Some apartments, those for the very rich, sell for 20 times the average per square foot of a building a few blocks away. Harvard's former president Larry Summers got in trouble, clumsily, explaining a version of the point and lost his job in the aftermath of the uproar. He was trying to say that males and females have equal intelligence, but the male population has more variations and dispersion, hence volatility, with more highly unintelligent men and more highly intelligent ones. For Summers, this explained why men were overrepresented in the scientific and intellectual community, and also why men were overrepresented in jails or failures. The number of successful scientists depends on the tails, the extremes, rather than the average, just as an option does not care about the adverse outcomes, or an author does not care about the haters. No one at present dares to state the obvious. Growth in society may not come from raising the average the Asian way, but from increasing the number of people in the tails, that small, very small number of risk-takers crazy enough to have ideas of their own, those endowed with that very rare ability called imagination, that rarer quality called courage, and who make things happen. The Thalesian and the Aristotelian. Now, some philosophy. As we saw with the exposition of the black swan problem earlier in Chapter 8, the decision-maker focuses on the payoff, the consequence of the actions, hence includes asymmetries and nonlinear effects. The Aristotelian focuses on being right and wrong, in other words, raw logic. They intersect less often than you think. Aristotle made the mistake of thinking that knowledge about the event, future crop, or price of the rent for oil presses, what we showed on the horizontal axis, and making profits out of it, vertical, are the same thing. And here, because of asymmetry, the two are not, as is obvious in the graph. As Fat Tony will assert in Chapter 14, they are not the same thing. How to be stupid. If you have optionality, you don't have much need for what is commonly called intelligence, knowledge, insight, skills, and these complicated things that take place in our brain cells. For you don't have to be right that often. All you need is the wisdom to not do unintelligent things to hurt yourself, some acts of omission, and recognize favorable outcomes when they occur. The key is that your assessment doesn't need to be made beforehand, only after the outcome. This property, allowing us to be stupid, or, alternately, allowing us to get more results than the knowledge may warrant, I will call the philosopher's stone, for now, or convexity bias, the result of a mathematical property called Jensen's inequality. The mechanics will be explained later in Book 5, when we wax technical. But take for now that evolution can produce astonishingly sophisticated objects without intelligence, simply thanks to a combination of optionality and some type of a selection filter, plus some randomness, as we see next. Nature and options. The great French biologist François Jacob introduced into science the notion of options, or option-like characteristics, in natural systems, thanks to trial and error, under a variant called a bricolage in French. Bricolage is a form of trial and error close to tweaking, trying to make do with what you've got by recycling pieces that would be otherwise wasted. Jacob argued that even within the womb, nature knows how to select. About half of all embryos undergo a spontaneous abortion, easier to do so than design the perfect baby by blueprint. Nature simply keeps what it likes if it meets its standards or does a California-style fail early. It has an option and uses it. Nature understands optionality effects vastly better than humans, and certainly better than Aristotle. Nature is all about the exploitation of optionality. It illustrates how optionality is a substitute for intelligence. We will use nature as a model to show how its operational outperformance arises from optionality rather than intelligence. But let us not fall for the naturalistic fallacy. Ethical rules do not have to spring from optionality. Let us call trial and error tinkering when it presents small errors and large gains. Convexity, a more precise description of such positive asymmetry, will be explained in a bit of depth in Chapter 18. The idea, present in California, and voiced by Steve Jobs at a famous speech, is "stay hungry, stay foolish." He probably meant "be crazy, but retain the rationality of choosing the upper bound when you see it." Any trial and error can be seen as the expression of an option, so long as one is capable of identifying a favorable result and exploiting it, as we see next. The rationality. To crystallize, take this description of an option. Option equals asymmetry plus rationality. The rationality part lies in keeping what is good and ditching the bad, knowing to take the profits. As we saw, nature has a filter to keep the good baby and get rid of the bad. The difference between the anti-fragile and the fragile lies there. The fragile has no option, but the anti-fragile needs to select what's best, the best option. It is worth insisting that the most wonderful attribute of nature is the rationality with which it selects its options and picks the best for itself, thanks to the testing process involved in evolution. Unlike the researcher afraid of doing something different, it sees an option, the asymmetry, when there is one. So it ratchets up. Biological systems get locked in a state that is better than the previous one, the path-dependent property I mentioned earlier. In trial and error, the rationality consists in not rejecting something that is markedly better than what you had before. As I said, in business, people pay for the option when it is identified and mapped in a contract, so explicit options tend to be expensive to purchase, much like insurance contracts. They are often overhyped, but because of the domain dependence of our minds, we don't recognize it in other places, where these options tend to remain underpriced, or not priced at all. I learned about the asymmetry of the option in class at the Wharton School, in the lecture on financial options that determined my career, and immediately realized that the professor did not himself see the implications. Simply, he did not understand nonlinearities and the fact that the optionality came from some asymmetry. Domain dependence. He missed it in places where the textbook did not point to the asymmetry. He understood optionality mathematically, but not really outside the equation. He did not think of trial and error as options. He did not think of model error as negative options. And 30 years later, little has changed in the understanding of the asymmetries by many who, ironically, teach the subject of options. An option hides where we don't want it to hide. I will repeat that options benefit from variability, but also from situations in which errors carry small costs. So these errors are like options. In the long run, happy errors bring gains. Unhappy errors bring losses. That is exactly what Fat Tony was taking advantage of. Certain models can have only unhappy errors, particularly derivatives models and other fragilizing situations. What also struck me was the option blindness of us humans and intellectuals. These options were, as we will see in the next chapter, out there in plain sight. Life is long gamma. Indeed, in plain sight. One day, my friend Anthony Glickman, a rabbi and Talmudic scholar turned option trader, then turned again rabbi and Talmudic scholar, so far, after one of these conversations about how this optionality applies to everything around us, perhaps after one of my tirades on Stoicism, calmly announced, "Life is long gamma." To repeat, in the jargon, long means benefits from, and short, hurt by, and gamma is a name for the nonlinearity of options, so long gamma means benefits from volatility and variability. Anthony even had as his email address at longgamma.com. There is an ample academic literature trying to convince us that options are not rational to own because some options are overpriced, and they are deemed overpriced according to business school methods of computing risks that do not take into account the possibility of rare events. Further, researchers invoke something called the long-shot bias, or lottery effects, by which people stretch themselves and overpay for these long shots in casinos and in gambling situations. These results, of course, are charlatanism dressed in the garb of science, with non-risk-takers who, Trifot-style, when they want to think about risk, only think of casinos. As in other treatments of uncertainty by economists, these are marred with mistaking the randomness of life for the well-tractable one of the casinos, what I call the ludic fallacy, after ludes, which means games in Latin. The mistake we saw made by the blackjack fellow of Chapter 7. In fact, criticizing all bets on rare events based on the fact that lottery tickets are overpriced is as foolish as criticizing all risk-taking on grounds that casinos make money in the long run from gamblers, forgetting that we are here because of risk-taking outside the casinos. Further, casino bets and lottery tickets also have a known maximum upside. In real life, the sky is often the limit, and the difference between the two cases can be significant. Risk-taking ain't gambling, and optionality ain't lottery tickets. In addition, these arguments about long shots are ludicrously cherry-picked. If you list the businesses that have generated the most wealth in history, you would see that they all have optionality. There is unfortunately the optionality of people stealing options from others and from the taxpayer, as we will see in the ethical section in Book 7. Such as CEOs of companies with upside and no downside to themselves. But the largest generators of wealth in America historically have been, first, real estate. Investors have the option at the expense of the banks. And, second, technology, which relies almost completely on trial and error. Further, businesses with negative optionality, that is, the opposite of having optionality, such as banking, have had a horrible performance through history. Banks lose periodically every penny made in their history, thanks to blow-ups. But these are all dwarfed by the role of optionality in the two evolutions, natural and scientific technological, the latter of which we will examine in Book 4. Roman politics likes optionality. Even political systems follow a form of rational tinkering when people are rational, hence take the better option. The Romans got their political system by tinkering, not by reason. Polybius, in his Histories, compares the Greek legislator Lycurgus, who constructed his political system while untaught by adversity, to the more experiential Romans who, a few centuries later, have not reached it by any process of reasoning, but by the discipline of many struggles and troubles, and always choosing the best by the light of the experience gained in disaster. Next, let me summarize. In Chapter 10, we saw the foundational asymmetry as embedded in Seneca's ideas, more upside than downside, and vice versa. This chapter refined the point and presented a manifestation of such asymmetry in the form of an option by which one can take the upside if one likes, but without the downside. An option is the weapon of anti-fragility. The other point of the chapter and Book 4 is that the option is a substitute for knowledge. Actually, I don't quite understand what sterile knowledge is, since it is necessarily vague and sterile. So I make the bold speculation that many things we think are derived by skill come largely from options, but well-used options, much like Thales' situation, and much like nature, rather than from what we claim to be understanding. The implication is non-trivial. For if you think that education causes wealth rather than being a result of wealth, or that intelligent actions and discoveries are the result of intelligent ideas, you will be in for a surprise. Let us see what kind of surprise. Chapter 13. Asymmetric payoffs behind growth, little else. The Soviet Harvard illusion, or the lecturing birds how to fly effect. Epiphenomena. Lecturing birds on how to fly. Finally, the wheel. Proto-Fat Tony thinking. The central problem is that birds rarely write more than ornithologists, combining stupidity with wisdom rather than the opposite. Consider the story of the wheeled suitcase. I carry a large wheeled suitcase mostly filled with books on almost all my travels. It is heavy. Books that interest me when I travel always happen to be in hardcover. In June 2012, I was rolling that generic, heavy, book-filled suitcase outside the JFK International Terminal and, Looking at the small wheels at the bottom of the case and the metal handle that helps pull it, I suddenly remembered the days when I had to haul my book-stuffed luggage through the very same terminal, with regular stops to rest and let the lactic acid flow out of my sore arms. I could not afford a porter, and even if I could, I would not have felt comfortable doing it. I have been going through the same terminal for 3 decades, with and without wheels, and the contrast was eerie. It struck me how lacking in imagination we are. We had been putting our suitcases on top of a cart with wheels, but nobody thought of putting tiny wheels directly under the suitcase. Can you imagine that it took close to 6,000 years between the invention of the wheel by, we assume, the Mesopotamians, and this brilliant implementation by some luggage maker in a drab industrial suburb? And billions of hours spent by travelers like myself schlepping luggage through corridors full of rude customs officers. Worse, this took place 3 decades or so after we put a man on the moon. And consider all the sophistication used in sending someone into space, and its totally negligible impact on my life, and compare it to this lactic acid in my arms, pain in my lower back, soreness in the palms of my hands, and sense of helplessness in front of a long corridor. Indeed, though extremely consequential, we are talking about something trivial, a very simple technology. But the technology is only trivial retrospectively, not prospectively. All those brilliant minds, usually disheveled and rumpled, who go to faraway conferences to discuss Gödel, Schmödel, Riemann's conjecture, quarks, schmarks, had to carry their suitcases through airport terminals without thinking about applying their brain to such an insignificant transportation problem. We said that the intellectual society rewards difficult derivations compared to practice in which there is no penalty for simplicity. And even if these brilliant minds had applied their supposedly overdeveloped brains to such an obvious and trivial problem, they probably would not have gotten anywhere. This tells us something about the way we map the future. We humans lack imagination, to the point of not even knowing what tomorrow's important things look like. We use randomness to spoon-feed us with discoveries, which is why anti-fragility is necessary. The story of the wheel itself is even more humbling than that of the suitcase. We keep being reminded that the Mesoamericans did not invent the wheel. They did. They had wheels, but the wheels were on small toys for children. It was just like the story of the suitcase. The Mayans and Zapotecs did not make the leap to the application. They used vast quantities of human labor, corn maize, and lactic acid to move gigantic slabs of stone in the flat spaces ideal for pushcarts and chariots where they built their pyramids. They even rolled them on logs of wood. Meanwhile, their small children were rolling their toys on the stucco floors, or perhaps not even doing that, as the toys might have been solely used for mortuary purposes. The same story holds for the steam engine. The Greeks had an operating version of it, for amusement, of course. The eolipile, a turbine that spins when heated, as described by Hero of Alexandria. But it took the Industrial Revolution for us to discover this earlier discovery. Just as great geniuses invent their predecessors, practical innovations create their theoretical ancestry. There is something sneaky in the process of discovery and implementation. Something people usually call evolution. We are managed by small or large accidental changes, more accidental than we admit. We talk big, but hardly have any imagination, except for a few visionaries who seem to recognize the optionality of things. We need some randomness to help us out, with a double dose of anti-fragility. For randomness plays a role at 2 levels, the invention and the implementation. The first point is not overly surprising, though we play down the role of chance, especially when it comes to our own discoveries. But it took me a lifetime to figure out the second point. Implementation does not necessarily proceed from invention. It, too, requires luck and circumstances. The history of medicine is littered with the strange sequence of discovery of a cure followed, much later, by the implementation. As if the two were completely separate ventures, the second harder, much harder than the first. Just taking something to market requires struggling against a collection of naysayers, administrators, empty suits, formalists, mountains of details that invite you to drown, and one's own discouraged mood on occasion. In other words, to identify the option, again, there is this option blindness. This is where all you need is the wisdom to realize what you have on your hands. The half-invented. For there is a category of things that we can call half-invented, and taking the half-invented into the invented is often the real breakthrough. Sometimes you need a visionary to figure out what to do with a discovery, a vision that he and only he can have. For instance, take the computer mouse, or what is called the graphical interface. It took Steve Jobs to put it on your desk, then laptop. Only he had a vision of the dialectic between images and humans, later adding sounds to a trilectic. The things, as they say, that are staring at us. Further, the simplest technologies, or perhaps not even technologies but tools, such as the wheel, are the ones that seem to run the world. In spite of the hype, what we call technologies have a very high mortality rate, as I will show in Chapter 20. Just consider that all of the means of transportation that have been designed in the past 3,000 years or more since the attack weapons of the Hyksos and the drawings of Hero of Alexandria, individual transportation today is limited to bicycles and cars, and a few variants in between the two. Even then, technologies seem to go backward and forward, with the more natural and less fragile superseding the technological. The wheel, born in the Middle East, seems to have disappeared after the Arab invasion introduced to the Levant a more generalized use of the camel, and the inhabitants figured out that the camel was more robust, hence more efficient in the long run, than the fragile technology of the wheel. In addition, since one person could control six camels but only one carriage, the regression away from technology proved more economically sound. Once more, less is more. This story of the suitcase came to tease me when I realized, looking at a porcelain coffee cup, that there existed a simple definition of fragility, hence a straightforward and practical testing heuristic. The simpler and more obvious the discovery, the less equipped we are to figure it out by complicated methods. The key is that the significance can only be revealed through practice. How many of these simple, trivially simple heuristics are currently looking and laughing at us? The story of the wheel also illustrates the point of this chapter. Both governments and universities have done very, very little for innovation and discovery, precisely because, in addition to their blinding rationalism, they look for the complicated, the lurid, the newsworthy, the narrated, the scientific, and the grandiose, rarely for the wheel on the suitcase. Simplicity, I realized, does not lead to laurels. Mind the gaps. As we saw with the stories of Thales and the wheel, anti-fragility, thanks to the asymmetry effects of trial and error, supersedes intelligence. But some intelligence is needed. From our discussion on rationality, we see that all we need is the ability to accept that what we have on our hands is better than what we had before. In other words, to recognize the existence of the option, or exercise the option, as people say in the business. That is, take advantage of a valuable alternative that is superior to what precedes it, with a certain gain from switching from one into the other, the only part of the process where rationality is required. And from the history of technology, this ability to use the option given to us by anti-fragility is not guaranteed. Things can be looking at us for a long time. We saw the gap between the wheel and its use. Medical researchers call such lag the translational gap, the time difference between formal discovery and first implementation, which, if anything, owing to excessive noise and academic interests, has been shown by Kontopoulos Ioannidis and her peers to be lengthening in modern times. The historian David Wooten relates a gap of 2 centuries between the discovery of germs and the acceptance of germs as a cause of disease, a delay of 30 years between the germ theory of putrefaction and the development of antisepsis, and a delay of 60 years between antisepsis and drug therapy. But things can get bad. In the dark ages of medicine, doctors used to rely on the naive rationalistic idea of a balance of humors in the body, and disease was assumed to originate with some imbalance, leading to a series of treatments that were perceived as needed to restore such balance. In her book on humors, Noga Arika shows that after William Harvey demonstrated the mechanism of blood circulation in the 1620s, one would have expected that such theories and related practices should have disappeared. Yet people continued to refer to spirit and humors, and doctors continued to prescribe for centuries more phlebotomies, bloodletting, enemas, I prefer to not explain, and cataplasms, application of a moist piece of bread or cereal on inflamed tissue. This continued even after Pasteur's evidence that germs were the cause of these infectious diseases. Now, as a skeptical empiricist, I do not consider that resisting new technology is necessarily irrational. Waiting for time to operate its testing might be a valid approach if one holds that we have an incomplete picture of things. This is what naturalistic risk management is about. However, it is downright irrational if one holds on to an old technology that is not naturalistic at all, yet visibly harmful, or when the switch to a new technology, like the wheel on the suitcase, is obviously free of possible side effects that did not exist with the previous one. And resisting removal is downright incompetent and criminal. As I keep saying, removal of something non-natural does not carry long-term side effects. It is typically iatrogenics-free. In other words, I do not give the resistance to the implementation of such discoveries any intellectual credit, or explain it by some hidden wisdom and risk management attitude. This is plainly mistaken. It partakes of the chronic lack of heroism and cowardice on the part of professionals. Few want to jeopardize their jobs and reputation for the sake of change. Search and how errors can be investments. Trial and error has one overriding value people fail to understand. It is not really random. Rather, thanks to optionality, it requires some rationality. One needs to be intelligent in recognizing the favorable outcome and knowing what to discard. And one needs to be rational in not making trial and error completely random. If you are looking for your misplaced wallet in your living room, in a trial and error mode, you exercise rationality by not looking in the same place twice. In many pursuits, every trial, every failure provides additional information, each more valuable than the previous one. If you know what does not work or where the wallet is not located. With every trial, one gets closer to something, assuming an environment in which one knows exactly what one is looking for. We can, from the trial that fails to deliver, figure out progressively where to go. I can illustrate it best with the modus operandi of Greg Stemm, who specializes in pulling long-lost shipwrecks from the bottom of the sea. In 2007, he called his then-biggest find the Black Swan, after the idea of looking for positive extreme payoffs. The find was quite sizable, a treasure with precious metals now worth $1 billion. His Black Swan is a Spanish frigate called Nuestra Señora de las Mercedes, which was sunk by the British off the southern coast of Portugal in 1804. Stemm proved to be a representative hunter of positive black swans, and someone who can illustrate that such a search is a highly controlled form of randomness. I met him and shared ideas with him. His investors, like mine at the time, as I was still involved in that business, were for the most part not programmed to understand that for a treasure hunter, a bad quarter, meaning expenses of searching but no finds, was not indicative of distress, as it would be with a steady cash flow business like that of a dentist or prostitute. By some mental domain dependence, people can spend money on, say, office furniture and not call it a loss, rather an investment, but would treat cost of search as loss. Stemm's method is as follows. He does an extensive analysis of the general area where the ship could be. That data is synthesized into a map drawn with squares of probability. A search area is then designed, taking into account that they must have certainty that the shipwreck is not in a specific area before moving on to a lower probability area. It looks random, but it is not. It is the equivalent of looking for a treasure in your house. Every search has incrementally a higher probability of yielding a result, but only if you can be certain that the area you have searched does not hold the treasure. Some listeners might not be too excited about the morality of shipwreck hunting and could consider that these treasures are national, not private property. So let us change domain. The method used by STEM applies to oil and gas exploration, particularly at the bottom of the unexplored oceans, with a difference. In a shipwreck, the upside is limited to the value of the treasure, whereas oil fields and other natural resources are nearly unlimited, or have a very high limit. Finally, recall my discussion of random drilling in Chapter 6 and how it seemed superior to more directed techniques. This optionality-driven method of search is not foolishly random. Thanks to optionality, it becomes tamed and harvested randomness. Creative and uncreative destructions. Someone who got a minor version of the point that generalized trial and error has, well, errors, but without much grasp of asymmetry, or what, since Chapter 12, we have been calling optionality, is the economist Joseph Schumpeter. He realized that some things need to break for the system to improve. What is labeled creative destruction, a notion developed among so many other ones by the philosopher Karl Marx, and a concept discovered, we will show in Chapter 17, by Nietzsche. But a reading of Schumpeter shows that he did not think in terms of uncertainty and opacity. He was completely smoked by interventionism, under the illusion that governments could innovate by fiat, something that we will contradict in a few pages. Nor did he grasp the notion of layering of evolutionary tensions. More crucially, both he and his detractors, Harvard economists who thought that he did not know mathematics, missed the notion of anti-fragility as asymmetry, optionality effects, hence the philosopher's stone, on which later, as the agent of growth. That is, they missed half of life. The Soviet Harvard Department of Ornithology. Now, since a very large share of technological know-how comes from the anti-fragility, the optionality of trial and error, some people and some institutions want to hide the fact from us and themselves, or downplay its role. Consider two types of knowledge. The first type is not exactly knowledge. Its ambiguous character prevents us from associating it with the strict definitions of knowledge. It is a way of doing things that we cannot really express in clear and direct language. It is sometimes called apophatic, but that we do nevertheless, and do well. The second type is more like what we call knowledge. It is what you acquire in school, can get grades for, can codify, what is explainable, academizable, rationalizable, formalizable, theoretizable, codifiable, Sovietizable, bureaucratizable, Harvardifiable, provable, etc. The error of naive rationalism leads to overestimating the role and necessity of the second type, academic knowledge, in human affairs, and degrading the uncodifiable, more complex, intuitive, or experience-based type. There is no proof against the statement that the role such explainable knowledge plays in life is so minor that it is not even funny. We are very likely to believe that skills and ideas that we actually acquired by anti-fragile doing, or that came naturally to us from our innate biological instinct, came from books, ideas, and reasoning. We get blinded by it. There may even be something in our brains that makes us suckers for the point. Let us see how. I recently looked for definitions of technology. Most texts define it as the application of scientific knowledge to practical projects, leading us to believe in a flow of knowledge going chiefly, even exclusively, from lofty science, organized around a priestly group of persons with titles before their names, to lowly practice, exercised by uninitiated people without the intellectual attainments to gain membership into the priestly group. So, in the corpus, knowledge is presented as derived in the following manner. Basic research yields scientific knowledge, which in turn generates technologies, which in turn lead to practical applications, which in turn lead to economic growth and other seemingly interesting matters. The payoff from the investment in basic research will be partly directed to more investments in basic research, and the citizens will prosper and enjoy the benefits of such knowledge-derived wealth with Volvo cars, ski vacations, Mediterranean diets, and long summer hikes in beautifully maintained public parks. This is called the Baconian linear model, after the philosopher of science Francis Bacon. I am adapting its representation by the scientist Terence Keeley, who, crucially, as a biochemist, is a practicing scientist, not a historian of science. As follows, academia leads to applied science and technology leads to practice. While this model may be valid in some very narrow but highly advertised instances, such as building the atomic bomb, the exact reverse seems to be true in most of the domains I've examined. Or, at least, this model is not guaranteed to be true, and, what is shocking, we have no rigorous evidence that it is true. It may be that academia helps science and technology, which in turn help practice, but in unintended non-teleological ways, as we will see later. In other words, it is directed research that may well be an illusion. Let us return to the metaphor of the birds. Think of the following event. A collection of hieretic persons, from Harvard or some such place, lecture birds on how to fly. Imagine bald males in their 60s, dressed in black robes, officiating in a form of English that is full of jargon, with equations here and there for good measure. The bird flies. Wonderful confirmation. They rush to the Department of Ornithology to write books, articles, and reports stating that the bird has obeyed them, an impeccable causal inference. The Harvard Department of Ornithology is now indispensable for bird flying. It will get government research funds for its contribution. Mathematics leads to ornithological navigation and wing flapping technologies leads to ungrateful birds fly. It also happens that birds write no such papers and books, conceivably because they are just birds, so we never get their side of the story. Meanwhile, the priests keep broadcasting theirs to the new generation of humans who are completely unaware of the conditions of the pre-Harvard lecturing days. Nobody discusses the possibility of the birds not needing lectures, and nobody has any incentive to look at the number of birds that fly without such help from the great scientific establishment. The problem is that what I wrote above looks ridiculous, but a change of domain makes it look reasonable. Clearly, we never think that it is thanks to ornithologists that birds learn to fly, and if some people do hold such a belief, it would be hard for them to convince the birds. But why is it that when we anthropomorphize and replace birds with men, the idea that people learn to do things thanks to lectures becomes plausible? When it comes to human agency, matters suddenly become confusing to us. So the illusion grows and grows with government funding, tax dollars, swelling and self-feeding bureaucracies in Washington, all devoted to helping birds fly better. Problems occur when people start cutting such funding, with a spate of accusations of killing birds by not helping them fly. As per the Yiddish saying, if the student is smart, the teacher takes the credit. These illusions of contribution result largely from confirmation fallacies. In addition to the sad fact that history belongs to those who can write about it, whether winners or losers, a second bias appears, as those who write the accounts can deliver confirmatory facts, what has worked, but not a complete picture of what has worked and what has failed. For instance, directed research would tell you what has worked from funding, like AIDS drugs or some modern designer drugs, not what has failed. So you may have the impression that it fares better than random. And of course, iatrogenics is never part of the discourse. They never tell you if education hurt you in some places. So we are blind to the possibility of the alternative process, or the role of such a process, a loop. Random tinkering, anti-fragile, leads to heuristics, technology, leads to practice and apprenticeship, leads to random tinkering, anti-fragile, leads to heuristics, technology, leads to practice and apprenticeship. In parallel to the above loop, practice leads to academic theories, leads to academic theories, leads to academic theories, leads to academic theories, with, of course, some exceptions, some accidental leaks, though these are indeed rare and overhyped and grossly generalized. Now, crucially, one can detect the scam in the so-called Baconian model by looking at events in the days that preceded the Harvard lectures on flying and examining the birds. This is what I accidentally found, indeed, accidentally, in my own career as practitioner-turned-researcher in volatility, thanks to some lucky turn of events. But before that, Let me explain epiphenomena and the arrow of education. Epiphenomena. The Soviet Harvard illusion, lecturing birds on flying and believing that the lecture is the cause of these wonderful skills, belongs to a class of causal illusions called epiphenomena. What are these illusions? When you spend time on the bridge of a ship or in the coxswain's station with a large compass in front, you can easily develop the impression that the compass is directing the ship rather than merely reflecting its direction. The lecturing birds how to fly effect is an example of epiphenomenal belief. We see a high degree of academic research in countries that are wealthy and developed, leading us to think uncritically that research is the generator of wealth. In an epiphenomenon, you don't usually observe A without observing B with it, so you are likely to think that A causes B or that B causes A, depending on the cultural framework or what seems plausible to the local journalist. One rarely has the illusion that, given that so many boys have short hair determines gender, or that wearing a tie causes one to become a businessman. But it is easy to fall into other epiphenomena, particularly when one is immersed in a news-driven culture. And one can easily see the trap of having these epiphenomena fuel action, then justify it retrospectively. A dictator, just like a government, will feel indispensable because the alternative is not easily visible or is hidden by special interest groups. The Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, for instance, can wreak havoc on the economy yet feel convinced of its effectiveness. People are scared of the alternative. Greed as a cause. Whenever an economic crisis occurs, greed is pointed to as the cause, which leaves us with the impression that if we could go to the root of greed and extract it from life, crises would be eliminated. Further, we tend to believe that greed is new, since these wild economic crises are new. This is an epiphenomenon. Greed is much older than systemic fragility. It existed as far back as the eye can go into history. From Virgil's mention of greed of gold and the expression radix malorum est cupiditas from the Latin version of the New Testament, both expressed more than 20 centuries ago, we know that the same problems of greed have been propounded through the centuries, with no cure, of course, in spite of the variety of political systems we have developed since then. Trollope's novel, The Way We Live Now, published close to a century and a half ago, shows the exact same complaint of a resurgence of greed and con operators that I heard in 1988 with cries over the greed decade, or in 2008 with denunciations of the greed of capitalism. With astonishing regularity, greed is seen as something A, new, and B, curable. A Procrustean bed approach. We cannot change humans as easily as we can build greed-proof systems, and nobody thinks of simple solutions. Is democracy epiphenomenal? Supposedly, democracy works because of this hallowed rational decision-making on the part of voters. But consider that democracy may be something completely accidental to something else, the side effect of people liking to cast ballots for completely obscure reasons, just as people enjoy expressing themselves just to express themselves. I once put this question at a political science conference and got absolutely nothing beyond blank, nerdy faces, not even a smile. Likewise, lack of vigilance is often proposed as the cause of an error, as we will see with the Société Générale story in Book 5. The cause was size and fragility. But lack of vigilance is not the cause of the death of a mafia don. The cause of death is making enemies, and the cure is making friends. Debunking epiphenomena. We can dig out epiphenomena in the cultural discourse and consciousness by looking at the sequence of events and checking whether one always precedes the other. This is a method refined by the late Clive Granger, himself a refined gentleman, a well-deserved Nobel in economics, that Bank of Sweden, Sveriges Riksbank Prize in honor of Alfred Nobel that has been given to a large number of fragilistas. It is the only rigorously scientific technique that philosophers of science can use to establish causation, as they can now extract, if not measure, the so-called Granger cause by looking at sequences. In epiphenomenal situations, you end up seeing A and B together, But if you refine your analysis by considering the sequence, thus introducing a time dimension, which takes place first, A or B, and analyze evidence, then you will see if truly A causes B. Further, Granger had the great idea of studying differences, that is, changes in A and B, not just levels of A and B. While I do not believe that Granger's method can lead me to believe that A causes B with certainty, it can most certainly help me debunk fake causation and allow me to make the claim that the statement that B causes A is wrong or has insufficient evidence from the sequence. The important difference between theory and practice lies precisely in the detection of the sequence of events and retaining the sequence in memory. If life is lived forward but remembered backward, as Schopenhauer observed, then books exacerbate this effect. Our own memories, learning, and instinct have sequences in them. Someone standing today looking at events without having lived them would be inclined to develop illusions of causality, mostly from being mixed up by the sequence of events. In real life, in spite of all the biases, we do not have the same number of asynchronies that appear to the student of history. Nasty history, full of lies, full of biases. For one example of a trick for debunking causality, I am not even dead yet, but I'm already seeing distortions about my work. Authors theorize about some ancestry of my ideas, as if people read books then developed ideas, not wondering whether perhaps it is the other way around. People look for books that support their mental program. So one journalist, Anatole Kaletsky, saw the influence of Benoit Mandelbrot on my book, Fooled by Randomness, published in 2001 when I did not know who Mandelbrot was. It is simple. The journalist saw similarities of thought in one type of domain, and seniority of age, and immediately drew the false inference. He did not consider that like-minded people are inclined to hang together, and that such intellectual similarity caused the relationship, rather than the reverse. This makes me suspicious of the master-pupil relationships we read about in cultural history, about all the people that have been called my pupils have been my pupils because we were like-minded. Cherry-picking, or the fallacy of confirmation. Consider the tourist brochures used by countries to advertise their wares. You can expect that the pictures presented to you will look much, much better than anything you will encounter in the place. And the bias, the difference, for which humans correct, thanks to common sense, can be measured as the country shown in the tourist brochure minus the country seen with your naked eyes. That difference can be small or large. We also make such corrections with commercial products, not overly trusting advertising. But we don't correct for the difference in science, medicine, and mathematics, for the same reasons we didn't pay attention to iatrogenics. We are suckers for the sophisticated. In institutional research, one can selectively report facts that confirm one's story, without revealing facts that disprove it or don't apply to it. So the public perception of science is biased into believing in the necessity of the highly conceptualized, crisp, and purified Harvardized methods. And statistical research tends to be marred with this one-sidedness. Another reason one should trust the disconfirmatory more than the confirmatory. Academia is well equipped to tell us what it did for us, not what it did not. Hence how indispensable its methods are. This ranges across many things in life. Traders talk about their successes so one is led to believe that they are intelligent, not looking at the hidden failures. As to academic science, a few years ago, the great Anglo-Lebanese mathematician Michael Atiyah of string theory fame came to New York to raise funds for a research center in mathematics based in Lebanon. In his speech, he enumerated applications in which mathematics turned out to be useful for society in modern life, such as traffic signaling. Fine. But what about areas where mathematics led us to disaster, as in, say, economics or finance, where it blew up the system? And how about areas out of the reach of mathematics? I thought right there of a different project, a catalog of where mathematics fails to produce results, hence causes harm. Cherry-picking has optionality. The one telling the story, and publishing it, has the advantage of being able to show the confirmatory examples and completely ignore the rest. And the more volatility and dispersion, the rosier the best story will be, and the darker the worst story. Someone with optionality, the right to pick and choose his story, is only reporting on what suits his purpose. You take the upside of your story and hide the downside, so only the sensational seems to count. The real world relies on the intelligence of anti-fragility, but no university would swallow that, just as interventionists don't accept that things can improve without their intervention. Let us return to the idea that universities generate wealth and the growth of useful knowledge in society. There is a causal illusion here. Time to bust it. Chapter 14. The Green Lumber Problem. Tension between episteme and trial and error, and the role through history. Does knowledge generate wealth, and if so, which knowledge? When two things are not the same thing. Green lumber, another blue. Where we look for the arrow of discovery. Putting Iraq in the middle of Pakistan. Prometheus never looked back. I am writing these lines in an appropriate place to think about the arrow of knowledge. Abu Dhabi, a city that sprang out of the desert as if watered by oil. It makes me queasy to see the building of these huge universities, funded by the oil revenues of governments, under the notion that oil reserves can be turned into knowledge by hiring professors from prestigious universities and putting their kids through school, or, as is the case, waiting for their kids to feel the desire to go to school, as many students in Abu Dhabi are from Bulgaria, Serbia, or Macedonia getting a free education. Even better, they can, with a single check, import an entire school from overseas, such as the Sorbonne and New York University, among many more. So, in a few years, members of this society will be reaping the benefits of a great technological improvement. It would seem a reasonable investment if one accepts the notion that university knowledge generates economic wealth. But this is a belief that comes more from superstition than empiricism. Remember the story of Switzerland in Chapter 5, a place with a very low level of formal education. I wonder if my nausea comes from the feeling that these desert tribes are being separated from their money by the establishment that has been sucking dry their resources and diverting them to administrators from Western universities. Their wealth came from oil, not from some vocational know-how. So I am certain that their spending on education is completely sterile and a great transfer of resources, rather than milking anti-fragility by forcing their citizens to make money naturally through circumstances. Where are the stressors? There is something that escapes the Abu Dhabi model. Where are the stressors? Recall the quote by Seneca and Ovid to the effect that sophistication is born of need and success of difficulties. In fact, many such variations, sourced in medieval days, such as necessitas magistra in Erasmus, found their way into our daily vernaculars, as in, necessity is the mother of invention. The best is, as usual, from the master aphorist Publilius Cyrus, poverty makes experiences. Hominum experere multa paupertas iubet. But the expression and idea appear in one form or another in so many classical writers, including Euripides, Pseudo-Theocritus, Plautus, Apuleius, Zenobius, Juvenal, and of course it is now labeled post-traumatic growth. I saw ancient wisdom at work in the exact opposite of the situation in Abu Dhabi. My Levantine village of origin, Amion, was pillaged and evacuated during the war, sending its inhabitants into exile across the planet. 25 years later, it became opulent, having bounced back with a vengeance. My own house, dynamited, is now bigger than the previous version. My father, showing me the multiplication of villas in the countryside while bemoaning these nouveau riches, calmly told me, "You too, had you stayed here, would have become a beach bum. People from Amion only do well when shaken." That's anti-fragility. L'art pour l'art. To learn for learning's sake. Now let's look at evidence of the direction of the causal arrow, that is, whether it is true that lecture-driven knowledge leads to prosperity. Serious empirical investigation, largely thanks to one Lant Pritchett, then a World Bank economist, shows no evidence that raising the general level of education raises income at the level of a country. But we know the opposite is true, that wealth leads to the rise of education, not an optical illusion. We don't need to resort to the World Bank figures. We could derive this from an armchair. Let us figure out the direction of the arrow. Education yields wealth and economic growth, or wealth and economic growth yield education.